We're not going to give that up. And if the federal agencies insist on going ahead and claiming that they're the ones that ought to get the money for the damage to these resources, then we'll do what we have to do, including litigation if necessary. It's just greed, that's all it is. And we'll get it sorted out sooner or later, but we're just simply not going to give up jurisdiction over the traditional fish and game species that we've been managing for years and years.
Mike Payne with the National Marine Fisheries Service says the whale has been dead for 2 to 3 weeks, and he's been tracking it for the past 7 days, waiting for it to hit the shore.
The most ironic thing is that the whale happened at the test site. That is pretty crazy.
Payne says it appears the whale was a victim of a tanker collision. It's a female, 22 to 25 feet long and weighing maybe 7.5 tons. Payne says the whale looks to have been dead too long to provide good samples for study. So the plan was to try to refloat the whale last night at high tide and move it out of the area. Payne says hopefully it will either sink or move back out to sea. The Corexit test was scheduled to begin at the next low tide, 5:30 this morning, but it all depends on the whale. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley. For the past 3 weeks, Rear Admiral David Cangalini has served as federal on-scene coordinator for the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup efforts. Cangalini returns today to his normal job in Juneau as commander of the U.S. Coast Guard 17th District.
My area of responsibility is all of Alaska, the chain, the Bering Sea, the North Slope, the area halfway down to Hawaii and out to the Russian border. That's my area of responsibility.
Yet this winter, Cangalini is hoping for a new assignment.
I would hope that the Commandant, when we shift into a winter modus operandi, would designate me permanently as a federal on-scene coordinator.
Back from a short R&R, Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins assumes the federal on-scene coordinator duties today. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
We have to find out what Exxon is actually going to do, as that's in... That's different from what the press releases are, we find. So we've got to be clear what Exxon wants to do. And if we feel that a supplemental effort has to be made, we'll do it. There's no question about it. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that the best way to handle it is to use the people who live in the area of the oil spill and to think of this as a community-coordinated effort. It isn't clear what will happen if we do, if we go in and we say, well, okay, we're going to clean it up, whether we are removing Exxon from the litigation by doing that. I feel like that if the job isn't being done, that we ought to go in there and do it ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I'm talking about the Alaskan people and not necessarily the government.
On Friday, Exxon representative John Peavy said at the urging of every village community, Exxon had requested a special permit from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, which would allow the special harvesting of 90,000 pounds of salmon.
Exxon is aware that because of the efforts that the villages have put forth, a lot of their boats and skiffs that traditionally do harvesting of subsistence stores were unavailable to do that. We are also very concerned about the elders in the community and those who are unable to receive subsistence stores. In the village communities, you will see that the young take care of the old in almost every case. That chain of events has been disrupted because of the fact that a lot of the younger people were participating in the oil spill cleanup.
PV said he had also spoken with local Department of Environmental Conservation representatives about the possibility of providing monitors for the program.
The reason for that is we would have to assure that it is DEC-approved product, that if anything were to be processed, caught or processed, that it would be free from any type of contamination whatsoever. We are going to recommend that monitors be placed in the canneries of where those fish would be brought to, and that a special processing stream be available to indicate that there is a certification on-site inspector who can give a clean bill of health to those fish.
PV said the possibility of using canned and fresh frozen product has been discussed. Two local processors are reportedly willing to help Exxon develop a program whereby people could work together as a community to help solve the subsistence problem. Peavy said the native communities are being asked to make boats available. If weather permits and conditions are safe, they would transit to a location in Akiak and Old Harbor where the fish could be harvested. ADF&G wants specific numbers of vessels as well as harvest numbers. They're concerned about escapements and over-harvesting in certain areas. Peavy says Exxon is aware of fears that subsistence product may be contaminated, especially in northern areas of the island.
We still are not of the belief that the fin fish, from all the technical details that we have received, have been affected by the oil. Now, that doesn't mean that a fear doesn't exist, and we understand that. And what we are trying to do, because of boat availability and because of this fear, try to come up with a cooperative program to assist. Exxon has offered to pay for all the fuel for the boats that transit down there, both to and from. We have also offered to work with the processors and pay for all the processing necessary to do this project.
Peavy said the time frame to pull the project together is limited. He urged Native communities to inform him as soon as possible about their interest in participating in the special cooperative subsistence program.
I hope they accept that offer. It was developed because of the urging of the Native communities, but there's a lot of people in those communities that have to address the situation. The leaders in those communities are trying very hard to make this an eventuality.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Mike Payne with the National Marine Fisheries Service says the whale has been dead for 2 to 3 weeks, and he's been tracking it for the past 7 days, waiting for it to hit the shore.
We've been following a gray whale for a week now. It was first seen down on near the mouth of the Sound off of Hinchinbrook Island, and it's been moving its way north in the shipping lane, drifting along with the tide, and it's kind of ironic that it ended up on Smith Island, the site of the test.
Payne says the whale didn't land right on the Corexit site, but it was close enough that that's what people were saying. He says it was a female gray whale, 22 to 25 feet long, and he's pretty sure it's the same whale they got a close look at last week.
Last Monday, the people from Johnston Point on Hinchinbrook, the whale camp people, went out and looked at it real close, and at that time they thought it had been dead for a couple of weeks already.
With the beaching of the whale on North Smith, Payne says there were a couple of options.
Either I could cut it up and maybe the samples would be good, maybe they wouldn't. I think they probably wouldn't be. And then we would have a carcass left there. Or else we could lift it off the island so that they could continue with their testing and move it out of that area into another location where hopefully it will either sink or move back out to sea.
Payne says it appears the whale was the victim of a tanker collision.
That I called back down at Cordova. The people looked at it real, real close when it was floating out in the Sound. Thinks it got hit by it looked as if it had been hit by a large, like a tanker. And the location where they found it, that makes a lot of sense. It was in the Narrows down there by where the tankers come in and out pretty frequently. And they think it's a victim of a collision with a ship.
According to Payne of the National Marine Fisheries Service, it's rather unusual to find gray whales in Prince William Sound.
And when they do come into the Sound, it's usually in the lower parts. They pass the Sound when they're going northwest earlier in the year when they're heading up into the Bering Sea to feed. And they're coming back now. They're coming back from Bering Sea, heading back south generally. And there are gray whales pretty much year-round from about Kodiak on. But there aren't that many gray whales really out at the mouth of the Sound this time of the year. They're here seasonally, mid-spring and then again mid-fall.
About 10 o'clock last night, with the assist of high tide, the near 7-ton dead gray whale was refloated, and Exxon hired a tugboat to tow it about 15 miles out from Smith Island. With the carcass removed, the final impediment to the Corexit test was out of the way. Exxon began using its chemical cleaner early this morning, and it's being closely monitored by Coast Guard, EPA, and DEC. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Would you prefer to have the ARCO building and the BP Exploration building with their thousands of employees, or would you rather have a steel industry or a pulp mill in our backyard?
Dwayne Hyman's analogy may not be perfect. There's little chance, after all, that Alaska's biggest city would be confused for a Rust Belt town. But Hyman, who's president of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, says it is time to consider what Anchorage would have been like if the oil industry hadn't come to Alaska and set up offices in the city's downtown. He praised oil workers as among the best paid and best educated of Anchorage's workforce, and he says leftover resentment 5 months after the Exxon Valdez oil spill is misdirected when it's aimed at most oil company workers.
Just because somebody works for an oil industry doesn't mean that they're personally responsible for something that happens. And in any event, the oil spill itself has created a lot of concern, and people that are totally unrelated to anything to do with the spill are being impacted. Children in school. I've heard stories of kids in schools that have gotten nasty comments from their little playmates.
A month-long campaign starts Monday aimed at repairing relations with the oil industry generally. The chamber's calling it They Are Us. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
We have not found through the research that there's any real significant disinterest or change of interest in Prince William Sound as a destination among Alaskans. I call it a mixed bag. Some of the operators are doing okay, particularly if they're catering to the oil spill workers at this time, like certain hotels or restaurants or, you know, transportation operations. However, some of the visitor products in Prince William Sound that were dependent upon the independent traveler driving their camper, their motorhome, or their own car down into the sound or taking the ferry and deciding on the last minute to take a cruise or some kind of an excursion in Prince William Sound, I mean, that traffic has been cut, and we don't know yet by just exactly what numbers it's been reduced by, but those operators are feeling the decrease in visitor traffic. One thing that we can do is to communicate the fact that there is a great proliferation, for example, of bed and breakfast operations in Valdez. I heard recently that there were now 107 bed and breakfast operations in the city of Valdez, which is a significant increase over a year ago. Also, they have increased the number of camper parks and campgrounds, and so it is possible to find a place to stay in Valdez. We're hoping that the tremendous amount of attention that's being given to Prince William Sound will eventually turn around to something positive for us in terms of the fact that from now on everybody will know where Prince William Sound is and what it is, and hopefully through our efforts we can make sure that they think of that in a positive light.
Of the 13 samples that we sent in to the FDA, 11 of them, local assistants said were clean. They looked okay. They inspected them, they smelled them, and they said these things don't look as if they've been affected by oil. All 11 of those resources called clean in the field by the local assistants were found to have low or undetectable levels of what are called PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are the most toxic elements in the crude oil.
The original permit issued to the Sealy incinerator barge was very strict and could justifiably have been challenged, according to DEC's regional program manager, Bob Flint. But Sealy accepted the permit as it was. Actually, there was a request to modify the original permit so that continuous monitoring would not be necessary, but Flint says that request came from Exxon.
We basically denied it, saying that, one, Exxon is not a party to the permit and therefore cannot request a modification. And that since the Sealy had accepted the permit the same day as is, it was curious to me of why they would want to modify it immediately.
So Sealy got the instruments necessary for monitoring, but when they tried to start up the incinerator, they couldn't reach the required pre-burn temperature of 1,700 degrees, and they had to shut down while they installed additional burners. Now Sealy has asked for modifications to the permit to reflect changes that had to be made, and Flint says Sealy admits it didn't think it could meet the permit specs in the first place.
They started off their letter saying, as we expected, we could not meet the conditions of the permit.
which again to us is a little bit concerning in that they accepted the permit. Why did they accept the permit is the question. If they knew they could not meet the stipulations of the permit, why did they accept it when they had the opportunity to challenge the permit at that point?
And Flint says it definitely concerns him that Seeley accepted the first permit.
Wouldn't it bother you if someone said, sure, I can do that, no problem. And then they tell you, then without doing anything really, they said, oh yeah, remember when I told you I could do that? Well, like I didn't think I could do it anyway.
Flint's not very pleased at now having to put more people to work reviewing modifications to a permit that was acceptable a few days ago. The incinerator has been ready for a go-ahead since the 23rd. But Flint says he's told Seeley that the very earliest his staff will have any sort of recommendation is the 30th.
I'm having to deal with staff limitations, but I want to make sure that my staff who's reviewing this have an opportunity to really look at this to make sure there isn't something that we're missing.
According to Flint, the reason for the close look is that the addition of the burners means that for at least part of the time, potential emissions from the unit could be tripled. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
I'm having to deal with staff limitations, but I want to make sure that my staff who's reviewing this have an opportunity to really look at this to make sure there isn't something that we're missing.
I believe that this is a responsibility of the people at Spildew Isle. I believe that there's government agencies and entities like ADEC that have this responsibility. And quite frankly, I'm not willing to inject the city into the middle of those types of responsibilities.
Harrison said Exxon already has contributed more to the cleanup effort than they originally promised. And he says now only 4 miles of impacted beach remain to be treated in the Gulf of Alaska.
We think that before the season is over, assuming we're not shut out by weather, we will have every significantly impacted mile that rains all the way down from Perryville through Prince William Sound. We will have all of that treated, cleaned up, environmentally stabilized, whatever you'd like to call that.
Speaking before the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and the Resource Development Council, Harrison said about 728 miles of beach in the Gulf of Alaska have been cleaned, and only 6 miles of heavily oiled beach remain to be treated on islands in Prince William Sound. Exxon is bioremediating the shore of Green Island, and Corexit is being used on the beaches of Smith Island. During the peak of the cleanup operation, Harrison said Exxon deployed more than 2 million man-hours, 300,000 feet of boom, and a cleanup force of more than 1,000 employees. But between September 5th and 10th, Harrison said, Exxon expects to have all cleanup personnel out of the Gulf of Alaska, and all winter efforts will be run out of Anchorage.
We'll be maintaining some float planes, turbo-powered float planes. We've got a fleet of helicopters that we're maintaining. We're maintaining some 150-foot-plus boats for contingency planning backup effort, as well as another twin-engine turbocraft. We're going to have a call-up list of experienced people. We will have village response capability, and what we're doing is making arrangements with the villages and communities that are in the impact area to do some monitoring and some pickup in the local area when the conditions are safe through the wintertime. Those arrangements are being completed at the current time. And we'll have some material stored at strategic locations.
Harrison said about 45% of the tugs, barges, and boats used in the cleanup are home-ported in Alaska or have elected to stay in the state through the winter. And he says that will help Exxon stay prepared to cover any operations that may be required through the winter time. Scientists will conduct 26 environmental studies during the winter months. Harrison says data will be taken from the heavily affected beach areas about every 2 weeks if weather conditions, daylight hours, and tides cooperate. Harrison said, in his opinion, Exxon is leaving the shorelines in good condition for the winter. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Michael Jones.
DEC's Dan Easton, acting for Division Director Larry Dietrich, denied Lawn's grievance on the grounds that the state was within its rights to reassign Lawn's work duties. The response cites unacceptable actions and physical misconduct by the aggressive DEC engineer, an apparent reference to an altercation between Lawn and an Exxon security guard in May. The denial also states that Lawn was reassigned to reviewing oil spill contingency plans to reduce the amount of overtime he was working on and, quote, to relieve stress. The state's response says Lawn was not demoted. Lawn's union representative, Bob Watts, immediately filed an appeal saying that DEC's actions against Lawn were clearly disciplinary and therefore Lawn was denied due process under the terms of his contract. The union says Lawn may not have been demoted, but he will be dropped from APEA's supervisor's bargaining unit and will lose some benefits as a result. Watts also stated that the action was taken without just cause. Lawn has been a constant thorn in the side of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, supervising oil spill drills and leading the state's investigation of a variety of pollution problems at the Valdez terminal. If this reassignment stands, Lawn will be largely restricted to reviewing oil spill plans, although Dietrich has said Lawn will not be prohibited from working on other issues relating to Alyeska. The grievance now goes to DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
I notice a number of environmental organizations have become more active on this, and I can't help but noticing that apparently there's somewhat of a fundraising benefit in the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Has the Federation noticed an increase in donations?
Well, we have established specifically a fund called the Alaska Fund, and we've gone to our members because we were getting dozens, hundreds of phone calls and letters from our membership, and we have 5.9 million members who want to know what they could do. Our members have expressed their concern with increased funding that is specific for Alaska, and we're going to be expanding our Natural Resource Center here in Alaska, and starting October 1st, we've got some major litigation underway right now, so there's a real opportunity to do some very positive things here in Alaska. We would have done those, though, without this kind of disaster, but the fact that so many people, attention to Lower 48, are riveted on the Exxon Valdez disaster, that certainly has helped that situation.
This commission, which you announced today, perhaps you could give me some idea what will distinguish this from the many other inquiries that are going on into the same matter.
Well, I'm aware that there are a number of initiatives planned, but this is really the first one where we, the citizens, are saying that if the government won't come and listen to the average citizen in Prince William Sound who's been affected by this, then we can do it ourselves. What we want to do is to receive that testimony from the citizens whose lives have been disrupted, put that in a published form, have appropriate kind of press associated with it, videotape it, and then if it's successful, as I think it will be, we'll take the citizen commission hearings to the Lower 48. My guess is many of the same kinds of inadequacies in terms of dealing with a disaster like this are going to be evident in a number of places along coastal cities of the United States. The challenge really, I think, and what we're trying to do is to get people to focus on this disaster, but with the realization that what this nation really needs is to develop a national energy policy. It's not just moving oil safer. We've got to do that. But the fact is we've got to eliminate our addiction to fossil fuels.
Isn't this just going to be another oil company bashing episode? I mean, what can you say to tell me that this isn't just going to contribute to more alienation between the people of Alaska and their main industry?
Well, it's clear that the state of Alaska, more than any other state, is addicted to big oil. 87% of your state government revenues come from the oil industry. And I see that the Chamber of Commerce here in Anchorage has started a hug and oily program. And there's no doubt about it that the rank and file Exxon employees or the oil industry employees are not the ones who ought to be battered by this. I mean, they, in all respects, are as much victimized by it by anybody else, and I can understand that there's a certain amount of psychological trauma that's being directed towards them that's unfair. However, I don't think it's all unfair to direct all of the passion and anger and forthrightness you can towards the leadership of Exxon. I was absolutely astounded when Governor Cooper told John Denver and I on Monday that not to this day has Lawrence Rawl, the chairman of Exxon, had even the simple courtesy to call him or to write to him. And that just to me is astounding. But it typifies the arrogance of Exxon and the top Exxon leadership about this. They just flat don't give a damn. They're in it to make money, and people need to realize that. And I think this has been a major and rude awakening for many Alaskans. And I think it's really going to cause Alaskans to reassess what their values are. For sure, in the near term, there's going to be a continued addiction to oil revenues to drive the economy and the government of the state. And oil has brought many positive things to Alaska, no doubt about it. But it's a finite resource. Oil is going to be gone someday. And I just hope that what's left is worth coming to see and for people to enjoy and people enjoy living here. And I think this requires a major refocusing on what Alaskans want for Alaska. And I hope that this public hearing process will help some of the folks who aren't empowered, who don't have big contacts with politicians, a chance to express their voice. And that's what we're really interested in doing, is having the people speak their feelings about what's going on and what's happened to them.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. Jay Hare is president of the National Wildlife Federation.
The filing deadline was yesterday, but John Devens, mayor of Valdez for the past 5 years, did not submit his petition for candidacy. Devens says the last few months have been difficult.
I think we all got hurt somewhat by the oil spill, and I'm just tired. From March 24th until now, I haven't had any free time. I've had 3 days to myself in all of that time.
The filing deadline is today in Cordova, but Mayor Erling Johansson has announced that he does not expect to seek another term either. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The DEC has granted the Kodiak Island Borough's request to prevent any burning in Vaikoto Bay until the permit review is completed. As a land manager, the borough wanted to comment on operation of the incinerator versus local land uses. The borough also wanted a public hearing before the permit was issued. Nearby Port Lions residents who oppose operation of the incinerator say they're relieved. Meanwhile, it's still under repair after damaged parts were discovered last week. In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
The Koktovik people discussed their objections to State Offshore Lease Sale 55 with borough planners and lawyers until well after midnight. They're seeking the borough's support to have the September 1988 sale revoked if possible, because they said they are afraid of the impacts of an oil spill on their subsistence way of life. During a recent survey, 52 of the residents said the sale should be revoked, while 15 said to put stronger restrictions on exploration. The matter is going to come up again in October when the state's Coastal Policy Council meets in Koktovik. Village residents have petitioned the council to hold an unprecedented adjudicatory hearing rather than just a weaker policy advisory hearing. But the oil industry has objected to this approach. The borough staff said they would meet soon with Mayor George Imawak and let Koktovik know how much support will be forthcoming. In Barrow, I'm Earl Finkler.
Test results on samples of subsistence foods gathered in the spill area by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game so far bear it out. Jim Fall, the regional supervisor in the subsistence division, says they used the advice of local people to pick the samples from places where foods have traditionally been gathered. All samples were given a smell test. And when contamination was detected by nose, it was also found in testing done by both state and federal labs.
Of the 13 samples that we sent in to the FDA, 11 of them, the local assistants said were clean. They looked okay. They inspected them, they smelled them, and they said these things don't look as if they've been affected by oil. All 11 of those resources called clean in the field by the local assistants were found to have low or undetectable levels of what are called PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are the most toxic elements in the crude oil.
The two samples that were contaminated were clams and mussels. It was an admittedly limited test done cooperatively by Fish and Game, the North Pacific Rim Native Nonprofit Corporation, and the State Department of Environmental Conservation. A much more elaborate program conducted by Exxon is also underway. But Fall hopes the test will give those who use the subsistence foods more confidence in their own noses. I'm Steve Heimel.
Spokesman Fritz Brunhoff says the still unnamed group will concentrate on a long-term oil cleanup operation based on a bounty system. The group also plans to do toxicity, environmental, and sociological studies. Organizers expect to run the grassroots effort in addition to plans proposed by government agencies. Brunhoff says the main purpose of the group is to let the ordinary Joe take initiative and have some control over the cleanup effort. He says, under state law, anyone is allowed to clean up beaches around the island as long as they remain within the intertidal zone. Brunhoff sees the effort as a way to clean up the oil without the legal restraints associated with state and federal funding.
when you get involved with state funding, okay, then you have to, the state has to deal with the Coast Guard, they have to deal with all the different agencies. We want the agencies to be involved, but because politics can take time, they can get a little entrenched, what we've seen, because I think a lot of them have done a great job, but because of the lawsuits, responsibilities and things because of what have happened, you know, here with Exxon, the oil spill, a lot of times their first concern is, well, you know, can we do this? You know, are we making ourselves liable? Whereas public people, as residents of Kodiak Island, we do not have to do that, you know, as long as we conduct ourselves in a responsible manner.
A volunteer steering committee will be made up of representatives of the entire Kodiak population to work out the bugs of a grassroots effort. At first, the group will try to solicit donations of food and small amounts of money. Later, they'll establish a nonprofit corporation to raise additional funds and implement the oil bounty system.
The idea around it is to set it up as closely based to normal fishing as possible. You could work out of a cabin, like let's say on a set net site, and collect oil. It would be up to that person to make contact with a tender that comes through the area to pick up the waste. The tenders would get a base price, fuel, and then after so many pounds, an incentive. So it would be just like fishing, basically. When you deliver your material to them, they'd look at it. There'd be some judgmental calls, just like there is in fishing. And they'd punch an oil ticket rather than a fish ticket, and that would go towards your account. And you'd also be able to pick up fresh supplies, fresh, you know, fuel, you know, fresh water, just as in a normal fishing basis.
Brunhoff believes there are some beaches facing Shilikof Strait that can still be cleaned and maintained well into October. One idea includes using floating cabins for crews of four people, rotating every 3 weeks. The group has already set up a computer system to track vessels and crews. They're still working on a communications network, a safety program, and a conditional land use permit. Brunhoff admits progress has been slow so far. Many of the people he would like to recruit are still under contract to Exxon, but he foresees an increased effort as Exxon's operation scales down. He says the money paid to cleanup crews will be enough to live on, but it won't be as much as handed out by Exxon. Concern for the environment and the desire to work hard will be the incentive for many to get involved.
They're going out there, they know they're not going to get rich, they're not on charter, if they don't work, they don't make money. It puts things back to the basic principles of the American way, so to speak.
That's Fritz Brunhoff, a spokesman for the still-unnamed nonprofit group now organizing to continue with oil cleanup throughout the winter. In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
The goal of the cleanup effort of the Exxon Valdez oil spill for this year is to remove the heavy oil contamination. Exxon says good shoreline treatment progress has been made, despite the onset of unfavorable weather. Exxon says less than 30 miles remain to be treated at this point. But there are serious problems with the treatment. NOAA's David Kennedy, who serves as scientific support coordinator, says when this year's work is over, there will still be oil remaining, as well as possible damage from the treatment itself. But he thinks the majority of the heavily oiled beaches will be treated this year.
Those aren't clean beaches, they're just treated beaches, and that's been said over and over again, but I think it's very true. There's a lot of oil left. One of the studies that we've conducted here in the last month has looked at the productivity of how clean the beach is after it's been treated. And we're finding that there's a fairer percentage of oil that's left on the beach, not necessarily on it, but certainly in it in many, many cases. So I think we're going to have the majority of the beaches treated. When we're all said and done, there's going to be an awful lot of oil left on these beaches. There's no question about that.
And just nothing we can do about it?
Not a lot that we can do about it. That's, I think, the real bad news.
The oil has weathered and changed in consistency over the past 5 months. At first, the cold water wash seemed to be effective in removing surface oil, but eventually the change had to be made to warm water and then hot water washes. Deputy Federal On-Scene Coordinator Coast Guard Captain David Zawadzki says the most frustrating problem has been not knowing what to do.
When you have
a spiller take responsibility, or it seems like they are, and let's assume that if you are satisfied, then the answer is quite easy. You can sit back and watch, and if you're not, that's one question, but then you have to ask, can you do it better? And we always, and this is the frustrating part about this particular spill, is having the tools in the toolbox that were adequate for the job, and they just weren't there, and really still really aren't, and that's been extremely frustrating, and not having those either here or in anywhere in the world.
More study is expected over the winter months to determine what should be and what can be done next spring. But so far, nobody knows what will happen during the winter. The state is concerned that treated beaches will be re-oiled by the subsurface oil rising to the surface or by surface contamination being moved to new areas during winter storms. Exxon scientists are sure that the winter storms will clean the beaches. But Exxon's winter plan outlines only local call-up forces for emergency response to that floating oil. It does not maintain the permanent winter strike force that the state desires. Federal on-scene coordinator Rear Admiral David Cengolini says negotiations over winter plans continue and nothing is set for sure. But he also says that unless the FOSC federalizes the project, which he's not ready to do yet, the FOSC can't tell Exxon or anybody else what to do.
That's my problem. I am a coordinator. I am not a commander. I have to coordinate, talk, cajole. That is what I do to try to get the job done. I have no authority to order anyone to do anything.
And that's essentially where we are and have been for quite some time, amidst negotiations between all agencies involved over every aspect of the cleanup, the winter plans, and what might happen next spring. Even as demobilization is in progress and vessels and manpower are being withdrawn from the oiled beaches. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley. Exxon reports that the Sealy incinerator barge on location in Herring Bay began waste incineration on the 31st with incineration rates of 3 tons per hour. Total burn to date is 135 tons. However, the Sealy barge had to suspend operations yesterday to make repairs to the conveyor system. Incineration is expected to begin again either today or tomorrow. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
It's probably just a matter of time before the first brown bear casualties from the Exxon Valdez oil spill are discovered. Oil washed heavily into some coves and tidal flats in Katmai National Park and was there as the bears came down the streams for the salmon runs. Park Superintendent Ray Bain says there are oiled bears at Katmai.
At this point, we do not have I cannot tell you with certainty that I have lost bears to oil impact. I can tell you that we have observed bears eating oiled wildlife, and that we've even seen bears caching, digging pits, and burying oiled wildlife for later consumption.
The effect the oil will have on the bears is a big question mark right now. 30 bears have been fitted with radio collars in an attempt to find out.
We fly the area, locate those bears, see where they are, see if there's any sign that they may be under impact.
So far, the tagged bears are surviving, but that does not give Bain and his wildlife managers much comfort. They know the bears have been consuming oil-contaminated food, not only fish and clams, but the tidal grasses.
We don't have any idea, but we anticipate we will have some negative impact on those populations. To determine how much is going to take an awful lot of study. We are going to have to track these animals for a long, long time. Some of this stuff may be insidious. It may require a long time to manifest itself in the animal. And manifestations can range anywhere from lesions in the interior intestinal tracts to possible loss of energy to anemia and possibly even having an impact on their reproduction capabilities. So it may take some time before all of that becomes evident.
There has never before in history been such wholesale destruction of our national parks. The widely publicized fires in Yellowstone are tiny by comparison to what's happened in Katmai, Kenai Fjords, Alaganuk, and Aniakchak. Managers say the effects on bears, otters, and birds will take years to measure. And beyond the oil, there's the huge amount of disturbance created by the cleanup effort.
And in an area where this never occurred before, that can be a tremendous impact. It may or may not have significant detrimental effects on reproduction, but we think it's having some. Most of the animals that come to our beaches and come to our coastal zone come there in part because they feel safe there. They go there because human interference is virtually non-existent, or at least it has been to date. And they've geared themselves, their reproduction and their feeding habits and their breeding habits have geared themselves to that minimal disturbance. And then when they arrive this year, of course, they're running into some substantial disturbances. As I say, those helicopters, which to them are, I'm sure, pretty threatening, and other activities, low-flying aircraft, birds trying to nest in on the cliffs, something goes by at low level, those birds may panic, and in the process of flying away, they can destroy their entire nesting areas.
Bain says their surveys indicate a low reproduction rate for the bird rookeries they're watching. As a manager, he's not sure the cleanup has been worth it. The beaches are still re-oiling themselves, and the wildlife is disturbed by the activity.
There are no easy answers here. We're working very, very closely with Exxon and with Vico. I'm sure that the people there are doing their very best to keep that under control. But again, it's still a disturbance.
The parks were isolated, remote, and unspoiled. They were so remote that managers often had only fragmentary knowledge of what their wildlife resources were. Bain says it's only because the Anchorage office ordered an immediate emergency survey right after it became clear that the oil was headed their way that they even have a chance now of knowing what the real spill impacts are.
Thank goodness that was accomplished, because otherwise we would have really been in the dark. We've had other research projects going on out there in the past, although fairly minimal. And with the realization that we were facing imminent catastrophe, if you will, I think that our regional office responded very, very quickly and very positively.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Tuesday morning, Community Development Director Linda Freed said the borough had received a verbal assurance Exxon no longer intends to burn oily waste anywhere in the Kodiak region.
At the word originally, I believe it was on Sunday, Pete Skorzoff called me and said that John Peavy had told him when they were both down in Olga Bay that Exxon intended to scrap the incinerator. They came back to town and had a town meeting yesterday, but we're not able to confirm that, and we're not able to get anything in writing. This morning, Jerome Selby called and talked to Wayne Purdom with Exxon here in Kodiak, and Wayne did confirm that they intended not to operate the incinerator and that he would get us something in writing. Until we get something official in writing that goes to DEC, we will continue to proceed just because we think that's in our best interest and the borough's best interest.
On the phone with the State Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Steve Provant, Freed found out that neither DEC nor Exxon in Valdez have heard anything about scrapping the incinerator.
Corbin said they have had absolutely no word there. He talked to the person that's in charge of the incinerator in Valdez just minutes ago, and he said they weren't planning on doing anything. That they're talking about filing as an intervener in the adjudicatory hearing, and they're waiting to see what happens with the coastal consistency review.
The Coastal Consistency Review is the purpose of Wednesday night's public hearing. Last week, DEC suspended Exxon's permit to give the public a chance to comment on the incinerator site. The borough will use the information to determine whether an incinerator is consistent with the borough's coastal management program. If Exxon isn't going to burn anything, there's no point in having a public hearing. But Freed says people who are interested in the incinerator issue should continue to prepare their comments.
Those comments are the only thing now that will stop that permit. And I guess we're just a little more suspicious than we might have been 4 months ago. That we want to see it in writing, and we want to see it in writing to the right people, as opposed to somebody saying, yeah, we think. Because we've been told by people here before that this is what's going to happen, and then suddenly, oh no, the director from Valdez is. And things change dramatically.
As of late Tuesday afternoon, Freed still had no word on the status of the incinerator, and local Exxon officials could not be reached for comment. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Exxon plans to have its workers off the beaches of the Kenai Peninsula by the end of the week. The company does not plan to do any beach cleanup work this winter, citing dangerous weather conditions. However, there will be a number of scientific studies being carried out, and Exxon has offered the city of Homer a chance to participate. Exxon wants the city to identify four local beaches and monitor them once every 2 weeks. The information gathered will be sent to Exxon offices in Anchorage. Exxon spokesman Dean Peeler said the company will give the city $70,000 to carry out the work. Peeler said the focus of the program is information gathering, but if the city wants to use the money for beach cleanup work, that's fine. Homer City Councilman Dan Calhoun didn't like the proposal. Calhoun, who is a commercial fisherman, thought the agreement was a political move to take some of the pressure off of Exxon if indeed oil shows up on local beaches this winter.
When the city of Homer is placed in the position of making the decision as to when it's to be cleaned up, and when there's an agreement between Exxon and the city of Homer that is our responsibility according to a signed agreement between us, then I can be very, very confident who is going to receive the political flack if the population disagrees with that. Quite frankly, I think that political flack, when it does land on the city's shoulders, is going to be misplaced. I believe that political flack should definitely land on Exxon's shoulders.
Other council members agreed with Calhoun, but said Exxon's offer was the only game in town. They said if they didn't accept the offer and oil does show up on local beaches, there won't be any money or resources available to mount a cleanup effort. Council members said they weren't all that interested in Exxon's scientific studies. They just wanted to make sure Homer beaches were protected. Councilman Don Ronda was a firm supporter of the agreement and said there was no reason the city shouldn't go ahead and sign it.
I don't think that we're going to get a better one. Certainly doesn't seem to me that it would be any better if we didn't have any agreement at all. We're monitoring for the winter. Without it, we don't have any monitoring of local beaches for the winter, unless we decide to do it at our own expense. So I think that just from that standpoint, I think it's worth entering this.
The council ended up approving the proposal after adding an amendment, making it clear the agreement does not relieve Exxon from any responsibility for future beach cleanup activity. Exxon plans to make similar proposals to other communities where there have been impacts from the oil spill. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
I don't plan to discuss contractual negotiations that are underway.
So you don't want to give us a picture of what you have in mind there?
No, I just don't plan to discuss contractual negotiations that are underway.
Exxon's weekly summary lists total personnel for September 5th as 9,176. That's down 728 people since this time last week. Total vessels deployed has also decreased and now totals 1,119. That's down 90 for the week. Skimmers, which had held steady at 38 through the 3rd, are now down to 29. Aircraft, which had been reported steady at 84, have decreased to 57. Exxon's landing craft total 51, barges 17, and berthing vessels 36, all decreased. Task Force 3 and 6 have been decommissioned. Offices are packing up to move to Anchorage. Environmental has already left. Total shoreline progress, Exxon says, is 1,084.5 miles. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Ever since the Exxon Valdez unleashed the nation's worst oil spill on Prince William Sound in March, fingers have been pointing in all directions, trying to fix the blame. Ex-tanker Captain Joseph Hazelwood, Exxon, and all the owners of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company have come under heavy fire for their roles in the disaster. In its defense, the oil industry has claimed that the federal government and the state of Alaska must also share some of the blame for the damage done by the Exxon Valdez. This week, APRN takes a look at the role of the state and federal governments in the events leading up to the spill, especially in the key issues of tanker safety and oil spill preparedness. In this first story, Peter Kenyon reports that the original vision of the state-of-the-art tanker technology for the Valdez fleet was lost because of three factors: shippers who didn't want to pay for the safety measures, a Coast Guard that bowed to the will of those shippers, in a state effort that was inconsistent at best.
As a cold fog settled on Hinchinbrook Entrance one February day in 1977, the state ferry Bartlett eased into Prince William Sound. In the wheelhouse sat a group of top Alaska environmental officials. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was scheduled to begin pumping North Slope crude in less than 6 months, and these officials were tired of waiting for the Coast Guard and oil shippers to address the hazards of moving large vessels through the sound. And they wanted to see for themselves what it was like to take a big ship through Valdez Entrance without the oil companies along. The Commissioner of Environmental Conservation at that time, Ernie Muller, recalls that actually being out there, in poor but not unusual weather conditions, confirmed their fears that the oil industry simply wasn't ready to guarantee the safe shipment of millions of gallons of oil every day through this rocky and sometimes dangerous body of water.
And of course it was thick fog, and we were sitting there in the pilot house watching the radar go around, and all of a sudden we see this little blip behind us, and the captain says, well, we should slow down. And he said, why are you slowing down? And he said, because there's a guy behind us in a skiff that I can see on the radar, and he can't find his way into Valdez. So we got in the back of the boat and looked out, and here was this little guy in a 14-foot Lund or something like that following the Bartlett in there. So.
DEC's findings from that trip prompted DEC official Alan Eagle to send a telegram to the Coast Guard. He paid for it out of his own pocket, he said, because everyone else is a gentleman and I'm not. Eagle's telegram condemned the Coast Guard's tankered traffic system as totally inadequate and failing to meet either the requirements of federal law or the environmental impact statement for the shipment of North Slope crude from Valdez. 12 years before the Exxon Valdez made U.S. oil spill history by leaking 11 million gallons into Prince William Sound, Eagle listed many of the same shortcomings that came under fire after the spill. Among his complaints, the Coast Guard's vessel traffic system was blind to all traffic south of Bly Reef. Navigation aids at Bly Reef, Middle Rock, and Valdez Arm were inadequate. There's no record of a reply to Eagle's telegram. And this was by no means the first warning. Public records and interviews with a number of present and former DEC officials involved with the pipeline project show that Alaska has been asking for tougher tanker standards since the early 1970s. But those same records show that the efforts to protect Prince William Sound were erratic and faded from view all too easily once the oil revenue began pouring in. As early as 1970, Walter Parker, working for the federal government to compare the environmental risks of a pipeline to Valdez versus a Trans-Canada line, had found a series of potentially dangerous flaws in the marine leg of the TAPS project. Then, a couple years later, President Nixon's Interior Secretary, Rogers Morton, assured Congress that the TAPS tanker fleet would be among the safest in the world, with double bottoms and hulls to protect against spills. But when Parker went to work for the State Pipeline Coordinator's office in 1974, he was shocked to find that despite Morton's eloquent assurances, the Coast Guard had no intention of forcing oil shippers to make those costly improvements. Looking back, Parker, who now chairs the State Commission looking into the Exxon Valdez spill, admits that Alaska and the environmental community were naive to let those assurances lull them into missing what may have been their best opportunity to achieve higher tanker standards from Congress.
Rogers, of course, the Secretary of the Interior, didn't have any authority to make a statement like that at all, but he was high-ranking in the Nixon administration, and he assumed he knew what he was talking about, but there was no plans really to improve tanker operations above and beyond what was accepted in international traffic at that time.
The efforts had failed largely because the Coast Guard decided that double-hull tankers needed to be agreed to by all nations that build the ships. The International Maritime Organization, a group dominated by the shipping industry, was implacably opposed to the costly changes in construction. In 1973, the United States had gone to the IMO conference with a strong position on double-hull tankers and found virtually no support at all. In Alaska, several attempts were brewing to try and convince transportation authorities that running the Valdez terminal like other shipping operations around the world was inviting disaster. In the environmental community, one of these efforts was led by David Rowe, a California attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund. He was interested in the TAPS tanker situation because of its possible implication for Pacific Rim environments. At that time, it was still considered possible that some Alaska oil might be exported. Rowe stumbled on what he called the grossly inadequate traffic safety system at Valdez and was stunned to find that very few people were really concerned about the issue, especially considering that the pipeline had been the preeminent environmental battle of the early 1970s.
We were astonished that, with all the concern about it, nobody had looked at the simple safety issue, which is once the oil comes out of the pipeline, Then what?
Rowe went to Valdez, discovered many of the problems that still remain today, and tried to make his case with the authorities. He says he was met with reactions ranging from polite disinterest from the state of Alaska and Congress to complete indifference by the Coast Guard. As Rowe put it, they knew better than we did how bad it looked, but they didn't want to hear about it. One of the things they didn't want to hear about, according to Rowe, was a series of tests run at the state of Alaska's insistence, using a supertanker simulator in the Netherlands. The Coast Guard hadn't seen the need for simulator tests or training, even though it was building its own simulator on Long Island at the time. When Rowe saw the results of those tests, he thought he knew why officials were downplaying their significance.
They took the best supertanker captains in the world, they took them to a supertanker simulator, which is something like a jet airplane simulator, and under severe weather conditions, every single one of the best supertanker captains in the world cracked up.
Walt Parker and Ernie Muller recall that the simulators also helped clear up other matters, for instance, downplaying the problems posed by Middle Rock, which had been getting much publicity at the time as a navigational hazard. But even with these simulator results, no one seemed to be pushing for the state-of-the-art tanker fleet Alaska had been promised. David Rowe began to appreciate the sheer power of a political steamroller.
You have to remember what an enormous deal the pipeline was. It's not kind, but it's probably accurate to say that the fix was in at the very highest levels. I'm not talking corruption, I'm talking about a decision that we're going to have this pipeline come hell or high water.
Several officials closely involved with the project offered nearly identical explanations. Given the size of the North Slope oil discovery, the continuing gluttony for petroleum products in the U.S., and the tensions involving imported oil, everyone knew there was no stopping this pipeline, and environmental concerns would be addressed as long as they didn't get in the way of starting up on time. And that was reflected in the pipeline oversight hierarchy. All the resource and environmental officials pooled their talents in a joint agency that operated as an advisor to the state and federal pipeline coordinators. The state coordinator was Chuck Champion, a former oil company worker who rejoined the industry after the pipeline was finished. Public records show that while Champion did push the state's environmental concerns at times, he tended to operate more comfortably with Alyeska and the oil industry than he did with the resource agencies. At one point, he threw a DEC official out of a meeting with Alyeska in order to have a frank and open discussion about how to deal with a particular environmental problem. So for the most part, the people in state government who agreed with the environmentalists that tanker safety was a problem, who in fact had been working on that very issue for years, were not in a position to do much about it. Still, Walt Parker saw another opportunity in the election of President Jimmy Carter. Parker briefed Carter's transition team, and the Georgia engineer appointed OMB Chief Burt Lance and Transportation Secretary Brock Adams to a tanker safety task force. With the President of the United States on their side, Alaskans looking for a safe tanker fleet for Valdez had their hopes high. But once again, the Coast Guard and the shippers won out. Lance left Washington in a banking scandal, Adams lost the ear of the President, and the Coast Guard and State Department combined to convince Carter to back off on the tough domestic tanker regulations while they made another run at the International Maritime Organization. At its 1978 conference, the IMO once again rejected double hulls, although it did adopt other, less expensive safety measures. For Parker, it was a disappointing defeat, but he had long since stopped being surprised by the way promises born in the heat of an environmental battle somehow failed to survive in the cooler world of economics.
Yeah, it all has to do with the cost of constructing tankers, and part of that is that the Coast Guard's citizen boards that review their efforts and provide the citizen oversight to their efforts are largely made up of the shippers.
But Parker and other officials agree that it's oversimplifying to simply cast any one agency as the villain in this story, and many agree that the obstacles placed in Alaska's way by industry and the federal government should have spurred the state on to an even stronger fight. And that's exactly what didn't happen. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.